You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, President Donald Trump names John Bolton as his new national security advisor. Would we be better off if he'd appointed Michael Bolton? My guests Tom Edwards, Daniel Bache and Ed Stocker will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including tomorrow's March for Our Lives. The post-Parkland gun control campaign prepares to descend on a chilly Washington, D.C. More legacy mastheads up for sale. Can they be revived, and if so, how? And Egypt's new state-run social network. Is it just a pyramid scheme? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle 24's Tom Edwards and Daniel Bache, and from our New York bureau, Ed Stocker. Welcome all to the program. Now, the retention of Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster as the United States National Security Advisor was supposed to be a reassurance that the lunatics had not taken complete command of the asylum, that there was a sturdy and serious bulwark against President Donald Trump doing something completely idiotic, like giving the job to John Bolton or someone. That particular aide to sound sleep has now been removed. Starting next month, Bolton, a hawk so hawkish he makes most actual hawks look like pigeons, will replace McMaster. Ed, in New York, first of all, how excited are people in America about this?
Well, I think if it was Michael Bolton, they might be even more excited. Maybe that's what we need to be talking about.
He's got nearly 2.5 more years to go, Ed. I would rule nothing out.
I'm not sure if excited is the right word. I think for some Republicans, like Lindsey Graham, who's been praising this move, for some hawkish Republicans, this is a great move. Obviously, for liberals, for Democrats, this is extremely frightening news due to things he said in the past about preemptive strikes. His likely stance, although we don't know his current status, as it were, but, you know, previous things he said about North Korea and the Iran deal, for example, the fact that he was one of the biggest champions of this idea that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction back in 2002 when he was part of the George W. Bush administration. Someone who clearly, as you said in that little introduction, who is extremely hawkish, and not just in the US but around the world, there is a fear that, you know, in the past there was this idea that it was the steadying generals who were almost there to manage Donald Trump. You know, part of the reason why McMaster, it seems, fell out with Donald Trump was that Donald Trump was very vocal in saying that he felt like he was being managed by McMaster. He doesn't like that. John Bolton is someone who has said that his job will be to make sure the bureaucracy doesn't get in the way of the decision-making of the president. Now, it's worth pausing on that, because that is quite frightening. Because, you know, before there was this idea that there were these intelligent, perhaps more rational personalities in the White House who were there to sort of steady the ship against the sort of knee-jerk reactions we've seen from Donald Trump on social media. The fact that McMaster is going imminently means that there are now fewer and fewer personalities within the White House. So there's a fear that the rhetoric of Donald Trump is going to become more of a reality, that, you know, a fear that the distance between this bravado rhetoric that we've been able to sort of say isn't really the truth is actually going to become the truth. And just to draw a kind of parallel between the administration of George W. Bush and the current one, we now just have one sort of possible lone voice of more rational behavior, which is Defense Secretary Mattis. And he's almost playing the role of Colin Powell during George W. Bush's administration, where he was surrounded by hawks. It will be interesting to see whether he sticks around. If he goes, it really will be the sort of dominance of the hawks. But just to summarize, it seems that, you know, this administration is shifting towards a more hawkish outlook, and with it, the distance between what the you know, what the president says and what he may actually do seems to be shrinking.
Tom, is there anybody more unhelpfully volatile Trump could have appointed to this role? I ask you to bear in mind that Charles Manson is dead.
Well, what's interesting about this is to, I guess, reassure people who are worried about that very question is to think back to the fact that Bolton has served under, I think, several Republican administrations before. And perhaps the key point, and I slightly take issue with what Ed says about the mirror of Colin Powell's role as a counterpoint to George W. Bush, because actually, George W. Bush, okay, there was Colin Powell, he was a counterpoint. You know, Condoleezza Rice, she was quite hawkish, but she was another counterpoint. Donald Rumsfeld, he was a counterpoint. And the point about Bush Jr. was that he surrounded himself with an inner circle of arguably equally hawkish at that point advisors, but there were a few of them. And he also didn't constantly turn over his staff. This is what we're into, mid-20s,
is it? This is the 25th senior official to leave the White House. Bear in mind that I wrote this bit of the script nearly 2 hours ago.
Well, quite. And we're only, whatever, a few months in. I think what really concerns me is the speed of the turnover and the fact that that speaks more to how erratic Donald Trump is. I mean, Ed made a good point about a sort of a buffer or a pause button on Trump's decision-making process. But we know from the way he engages on social media platforms and the way he makes decisions generally, including hiring and firing, that he does do these things on a whim. That alarms me in a way more than the politics of Bolton. Sure, he's hawkish, but I think he's seen enough frontline politics. He has been in the Oval Office at times of crises. It's alarming. And the kind of rhetoric he's produced, particularly on Korea, on Iran, is alarming. But I think I hope, despite what you see on Fox, that he actually does understand how to counterbalance that when he's actually in a position of authority.
Daniel, on the subject of that White House revolving door, which is now whirring so quickly you could use it as some sort of giant-sized blender, is Trump going to have a problem? Or is he having a problem, even if he had the best will in the world, which he clearly doesn't, but even if he did, is there going to be a difficulty finding, how to put it, non-Yahoos who actually want to work for this administration? Because it is, frankly, unlikely to end well.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there is a way that it can end well. And for me, I think it's really surprising that it took him so long to bring Bolton into the fold. And he does fit the bill of sort of the crazy, as you say. I mean, this is a guy as strong-headed as Trump, and so he doesn't seem to really fit that role, the same reason McMaster was taken out of the fold. But I think he'll be there for a while, especially to help Trump move forward with things like North Korea.
Okay, well, let's stay in the United States and look ahead to tomorrow's March for Our Lives. These are demonstrations in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere by school students and others who believe that it should be possible to complete one's education in reasonable expectation of not getting shot. The demonstrations are the latest in a series of protests in favor of gun control following last month's school shooting in Parkland, Florida, protests which have been substantially orchestrated by the school students. Parkland was the 8th school shooting this year, which resulted in death or injury. There have been 9 more since. One of the students injured in the most recent, at a high school in Maryland on Tuesday, died today. She was Jalen Willey, aged 16. Ed, to you first. The weather in DC tomorrow looks inhospitable. What are people anticipating by way of turnout?
Well, they're talking about as much as 500,000 protesters expected. I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens, but I think there seems to be a momentum behind this. I mean, it's always difficult to know if this will be a flash in the pan. I mean, I've been in the US for 4 years, and what I will say is that, it feels a bit different this time. It feels that there is more publicity. I mean, you look at what happened in Sandy Hook and Columbine, and sure, there was coverage, but it sort of ended. It feels that there is some sort of a movement building, certainly. You know, brands are also getting behind this movement as well. It will be super interesting to see, the numbers we have, not just in DC, but as you said, they're going to be, I'm sure, big marches also around the country, including Los Angeles and here in New York City. So it will be interesting to see, you know, how big those numbers are, and if politicians, which they haven't done ever before, really, actually stand up and take notice. I mean, what's interesting today as well as a sort of precursor to the marches is that also some of those students from Parkland in Florida, the site of that shooting 37 days ago, a lot of them have been meeting with certain lawmakers, including, for example, Joe Biden. They've been making statements on Capitol Hill. One person said today, "America, we are your future. Why won't you protect us?" You know, powerful words that are getting national coverage across pretty much all of the TV networks. As I say, it will be interesting to see if there's enough momentum behind this to keep it carrying forward, because that's always the big question, isn't it? You can have a big march, but then does it die out? So if the momentum continues, there's going to be a point if it's able to continue. And we're seeing, for example, Parkland students editing the American website of The Guardian today. They're getting a lot of high profile coverage. If that movement continues, there will be a point, we hope, injecting a bit of my personal opinion in there, that there is finally a change to some of the gun laws here in the US.
Daniel, one eyebrow-arching statistic I read today was a reasonably well-worked-out estimate that 200,000 American students have experienced a shooting at their school. Is it possible that we have reached the kind of critical mass that is necessary for a culture to change? Because it does strike me that this has to be one of those things where probably a law is not going to be enough. There actually has to be a change in the culture, which perhaps can be echoed by a change in legislation.
I think so. I mean, going back, it's almost 20 years now since Columbine. Incredible. And I think now with those statistics, there has to be some sort of shift. And as Ed mentioned there, the momentum seems to be continuing here. With other events, it hasn't really seemed to taper off. These young students have the media coverage. We've got really eloquent young speakers who are making names for themselves in this very interconnected world. The organization is actually pretty impressive. And as we're talking about, they have meetings with politicians. I think there actually is there is something really brewing here.
Tom, it is that question of momentum. And how is, well, I'll start that sentence again. What is the best way forward? Assuming tomorrow is a success and assuming there are huge numbers across America, as seems likely, what can or should they do after that to stop the thing evaporating?
Well, I think the most telling point is perhaps what Daniel just said there about the erudition, the extraordinary way that some of these students have articulated what they experienced. And I forget, was it a student who challenged, was it Marco Rubio just a couple of
weeks
ago?
Rubio has been directly challenged. President Trump was directly challenged.
Rubio one was particularly striking because he was outthought, he was outmaneuvered by a student.
And he look completely spooked, didn't
and
he?
And the media's engagement with this, especially the liberal and centrist media, I think speaks to a desperation for a better quality of political dialogue, particularly around this issue. I think the depressing reality is we could be looking at least a generational shift, maybe two generations. And it may only be when those articulate individuals that Daniel was just talking about are themselves standing for higher office that we can actually get anywhere. I don't want to be a naysayer, and I don't want to sort of pour, scotch the sort of optimism which Ed was talking to. He's been in the States, of course, for a long time. He's seen these things happen. But I just feel like it is slightly empty. There does seem to be a difference in the tenor of the discussion. And there's a different tone struck by the protagonists in the discussion because it's being led by students, I think, for the first time that I can remember. I don't see any difference. If you look at what even state legislatures were trying to get on the agenda, they couldn't even bring forward a discussion about gun control. And the only really meaningful moves have come from the private sector, certain companies. But they've even done that before. You know, Dick's Sporting Goods, they took long rifles out before and then they came back. I don't share the you know, limited optimism even of my co-panelists, I regret to say I don't think that there's anything that can be done until a constitutional level change is made. And I just can't see that happening.
Ed, what sense do you get of how the gun lobby is going to play this weekend? Because as Tom was saying, a lot of the traditional pro-gun voices have been caught out by the post-Parkland response. They didn't see it coming. They don't know how to answer it. And it's very hard to claim the moral high ground from a bunch of kids who are just explaining that they're getting kind of tired of getting shot at. What do the NRA and their fellow travellers do about a large-scale demonstration, if that's what it proves to be, in favour of that proposition?
I mean, just to talk about what Tom was saying very briefly, I mean, I agree with that to a certain extent. I think it's an extreme uphill battle in terms of politicians. There are a lot of people who are reticent about any sort of change, and so it's an extreme struggle. And it's true, too, that there are certain brands who have made stands before. What I don't remember is the amount of brands that have stood up, including airlines who have been prepared to take on the NRA, etc., etc. I'm not sure it's enough to bring about immediate change, but at least there's a conversation taking place, and there could be a huge march, and there seems to be perhaps more momentum than there's been in the past. But if we talk about the NRA, it's going to continue to do what it always has done, which is lobby fiercely. One mustn't underestimate for any second the sheer amount of power and ability to organise, including at a grassroots level that it has, the serious amount of funding and funds that it has, and the ability to a certain extent that it has to make or break politicians' careers. Remember that the NRA, helps, donates money to political figures, and, a lot of people a lot of politicians are reliant on the NRA and scared of meddling with it. So it has a huge power, and that's not something that's going to disappear overnight, and it's not going to be something that, shifts a lot of politicians. So although, yes, there's this moral high ground you referred to, Andrew, of these students, and it's amazing to see it coming from that level, from the people who have been, directly affected by gun crime in schools. But I think when it comes to politicians and change, that's the difficulty. Because when I was talking about a shift, I think it's coming more from society, isn't it? Although I did see a figure today that over 50% of Americans feel that guns, make America more secure. So there's still, a deep-rooted belief that, guns can help protect people. And we see that from politicians as well. When a crime happens of this sort, often they say that, we need more guns. That's coming from top politicians. So although there's segments of society who are wanting change, and this could grow as a movement within society, the main issue is a sort of intransigent Congress that doesn't seem to be doing enough to get anything changed from fear for the NRA, from fear of constituents, for a number of reasons. And we'll just have to see whether, if the sort of movement continues to grow, that pressure will be enough to exert real change at the heart of Capitol Hill.
Okay, well, there's more on this subject on tomorrow's edition of The Foreign Desk at midday London time. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Tom Edwards, Daniel Bache and Ed Stocker. Coming up next, would you buy a magazine people aren't buying?
Monocle's April edition kicks off in a golf buggy in Indonesia, where President Joko Widodo takes us on a tour of the palace grounds and talks hardline groups, upcoming elections and wanting to create 10 new Barleys. As our biannual fashion and retail special, it's also one of the sleekest issues of the year. We sit down with Angela Arendts, Senior Vice President of Retail at Apple Inc., to discuss how Apple stores can remedy our growing sense of isolation and profile the bricks and mortar players shaking things up in our retail survey. Our Style Top 50 counts down the brands and looks to covet this spring, plus laments the frayed fortunes of US clothing manufacturers. Elsewhere, we sing the praises of Canary Island wine, visit Dakar's burgeoning art scene, and check out the best in Scandi design at the Stockholm Furniture and Lighting Fair. Plus, we make merry with the glassblowers and woodbenders in the Czech Republic. Monocle's April issue is out now. Do get your copy or subscribe at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Daniel Bache, and Ed Stocker. Now, when Time Inc. was bought last year for $2.8 billion, there was considerable speculation about what new owner Meredith might do with Time's stable of legacy titles. We now have a better idea. Following the unloading of Time Inc.'s UK titles, it's now looking to do the same with such storied mastheads as Sports Illustrated, Fortune, Money, and Time magazine itself. Daniel, first of all, if you had, you know, I'm guessing several billion dollars to spend, would you be interested in that portfolio of titles?
In all of them? maybe one.
You drive a hard bargain. Yeah.
I don't know if I would be getting into this business at this time, but I can say that these titles really have a strong reputation, and someone has to be able to do something with them. It's so interesting that Meredith is saying, we're not the right people to manage this. So you wonder then, who is? It's not
and
me.
And also, why did you buy Time Inc.?
Exactly.
Ed, in New York, are they still regarded as big deals in the United States, which is obviously where they were born and where they made their reputation? Do people still take them seriously?
Excuse me. That stable of publications, yes. I mean, obviously, they have history, don't they? They're storied publications. I mean, the issue really at the center of all of this is it may seem strange that Time Inc. wants to, well, I guess it's now Meredith, but wants to get rid of Time. But, you know, Time is a publication that, although has an incredible history, has been struggling recently. And Meredith is really, I don't want to say slashing and burning, but it's making very, very tricky decisions based on the market. You wonder why it decided to buy a whole stable of publications and then arguably get rid of the most famous of them all. But the most famous of them all are also ones that are struggling, and they deem it a burden. So we're now hearing about, you know, 200 jobs being cut immediately and 1,000 more over the next 10 months, which is a pretty epic figure. Of course, it's testament to the fact that, yes, the print magazine industry is struggling, and Meredith has decided that it doesn't want to be saddled with publications that it thinks are struggling. Now, of course, if an owner came in with more vision, who was prepared to invest and try and rescue these publications, they might make a good stab of it. Meredith clearly is not a figure that is interested in doing that in any sense of the word. It's more interested, it seems, in hanging on to the more tabloid side of Time Inc.'s business, the ones that have huge numbers of readers and are fairly stable. We're talking about the People's of this world, People magazine. It seems that they're, you know, consolidating those publications and casting off ones that they're not prepared to invest in trying to rescue.
Tom, if as a result of some sort of unfathomable brainstorm, the new owners of Time or Sports Illustrated or even Fortune or Money offered you the job of editor, how would you go about reviving the titles?
I think there needs to be a return to traditional values. And I think, you know, we demonstrate this at Monocle. I think there are other titles that do it. If you have a backer with deep pockets and a longer term view, then you've got the luxury of time, forgive the pun, to turn things around. What Time needs to do is to reclaim its authority. It's thin, it's flimsy, there's bulk copies given away. I was talking with our own editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, about this. He was saying what this needs is it needs to be fat, it needs to be authoritative, it needs to retrieve its premium
these
quality.
These things do matter, don't they?
The fact
that you're absolutely right, it's always been my impression of Time magazine. You feel like it'll blow away in
It feels like a freebie, Andrew, and that's the problem. I think you've got to think about what Meredith are doing. I actually think they telegraphed this, that they were going to do this from the get-go. They wanted to consolidate their strong holding in that very much more consumer-focused, glossy sector, and they do that. And it's expedient for them to buy the whole Time Inc. stable, pick off the pieces they wanted that work for their business model, shift a lot of backroom to Des Moines to save money. They want to save $500 million in 2 years. They're probably going to do it. But there's an opportunity here. I think the most sensible thing would be to look for individual owners. There's probably a company, an individual for whom Sports Illustrated could be a flagship mark. Certainly Time. Here's a challenge for somebody out there. A lot of the big shifts in media ownership have been driven by Silicon Valley. You've seen the Washington Post going to Bezos and so on and so forth. Maybe this is the new generation of super billionaires, you know, the old press, the pressmen of the days of yore. Why not say to a Mark Zuckerberg, his company's reputation is being damaged by what's happened. Why not say to a Zuckerberg, look, put your billions where your mouth is. Why doesn't Facebook take a title like Time? Why doesn't Facebook properly invest in journalism, revitalize a heritage mark, and show that it can take this sort of agenda seriously? I've laid down the gauntlet to him. Why not?
They should hire you.
Well, yes, indeed they should. Not that we're trying to get rid of you, Tom. But I'm
glad to hear.
but finally tonight, what with one thing and another, it has not been a good week or so for the image of social networks. Indeed, in some more excitable quarters, the argument has even been raised that such platforms have become too important to be entrusted to private companies. Egypt is way ahead of this, preparing to launch a government-run social network called EgyptFace, which is to say a network which will enable the harvesting of the citizenry's thoughts, plans, preferences and conversations by one of the world's grimmer police states. It has already been redubbed by online wags EggFace, which is a bad start. But Daniel, what else could possibly go wrong here?
I think this is as wrong and as low as it gets, really. I mean, I think the meme or the image I saw of the front of this, it looked like Mo Salah, like the Liverpool football player, with like a genie lamp.
We don't know whether or not it is Mo Salah. We were trying to...
were you? And then the interface, the look of it, is an exact copy of Facebook. And it just, I mean, all the reaction I've seen is basically, this is just a ploy to get people to punch in their details that's going to go straight to Egypt, but that's the government. That's already happening all over the world anyways, as we've seen with Cambridge Analytica and all that. But the government actually coming out and saying, hey, come play with us, it can't go more wrong.
But Tom, is this potentially the future? If I was running a police state dictatorship, a man can dream. It seems like the way forward. You ban Facebook and Twitter and American-run social networks, and you say to your citizens, yeah, you can have a social network, but this is the one there is.
Well, can I just say, if you were running a police state, I would actually join that social network just out of interest. I mean, you could argue, if you adopt that slightly skewed worldview, that there is some sort of weird candor, a strange kind of honesty. Is it more transparent for a state to say, this is part of our government apparatus, sign up, you know who you're dealing with? I mean, it could be the sort of end game of the suspicions that have been knocking around social media recently. It just seems a bit clunky. It's a bit brazen. I thought Egypt face was what the Sphinx was suffering from all these years. So what do I know?
But a more serious point, in light of what we have learned in the last week or two, have either of you, and I'll ask you first, Daniel, changed your online behaviour or your views of whether being on a social network is a good thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as we've seen, they're not to be really trusted if you value any of your privacy. I think so many of them are quite good in the way that we communicate, Twitter, Instagram, that sort of thing. But where we've got Facebook and others where their end game is selling your data off or allowing third parties and companies in to capitalize on that data, I think that for me has been hugely problematic, and it's absolutely changed the way that I interact online or the way that I share things online. I think Facebook is increasingly irrelevant, but I mean, maybe Twitter is as well.
Tom, have you expunged your online presence?
It wasn't much to begin with, but it's merely sort of confirmed my scepticism. I think the important thing here is this broader question about regulation. I know we don't have time for this, but Mark Zuckerberg was talking about, you know, is it even time for something of this scale to look at some sort of regulatory mechanisms? I know they're often the enemy of innovation, but you have to always remind yourself the pace of development in this field, technologies. You know, we've seen some of these social networks rise and fall in the time since we last had a proper overhaul of that. I think they're too big to go untrammeled. I think we need some sort of international regulatory mechanisms. And in the current environment, where everyone's getting along, hands across the ocean, it should be easy street to do that, right?
On that insanely optimistic note, that brings us to the end of today's show. Tom Edwards, Daniel Bache, and Ed Stocker, thanks all for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, The Menu with Marcus Hippie. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.